Macmillan Audio presents Sizzling 16 by Janet Ivanovich. Read for you by Lorelei King. Chapter 1. My Uncle Pip died and left me his lucky bottle. I suppose I'm fortunate because he left my Grandma Mazur his false teeth. So I've got this bottle now, and I don't exactly know what to do with it. It's not like I have a mantle. My name is Stephanie Plum, and I live in a bare-bones apartment on the outer edge of Trenton, New Jersey. I share the apartment with my hamster Rex, and he doesn't know what to do with the bottle either. The lucky bottle is the size and shape of a beer bottle. The glass is red, and it looks hand-blown. It's not entirely ugly, especially if you like beer, but it's also not exotically pretty. And so far, it hasn't been very lucky. I have the bottle sitting on my kitchen counter between Rex's hamster cage and the brown bear cookie jar that holds my gun. It was Monday morning, halfway through June, and Lula was in my apartment doing a pity pickup because my hunk of junk car was dead and I needed a ride to work. "Huh," Lula said. "What's that red bottle on your counter?"
"It's my lucky bottle."
"Oh, yeah? What's so lucky about it? It don't look too lucky to me. Looks like one of them designer beer bottles, only it's got a fancy glass stopper in it."
"It's my inheritance from Uncle Pip."
"I remember Uncle Pip," Lula said. "He was older than dirt, right? Had a big carbuncle on his forehead. He was the one wandered out of the senior complex a couple weeks ago during that thunderstorm, pissed on a downed electric wire and electrocuted himself."
"Yep, that was Uncle Pip." I'm a bond enforcement agent working for my cousin Vinny, and Lula is the office file clerk, wheelman, and fashion maven. Lula likes the challenge of fitting her plus-size body into a size 8 poison green spandex miniskirt and leopard print top, and somehow it all comes together for Lula. Lula's skin is milk chocolate, her hair this week is fire engine red, and her attitude is pure Jersey. I'm a couple inches taller than Lula, and where her body is overly voluptuous, mine is more 34B. My idea of fashion is a girl-cut stretchy t-shirt, jeans, and sneakers. My skin is nowhere near chocolate. My shoulder-length, naturally curly hair is plain old brown and often pulled back into a ponytail. My eyes are blue, and I'm still trying to find my attitude. I hung my purse on my shoulder and pushed Lula to the door.
"We need to move. Connie called 10 minutes ago, and she sounded frantic." "What's with that?" Lula said. "Last time Connie was frantic was never."
Connie Rizzoli is the bail bonds office manager. My heritage is half Italian and half Hungarian. Connie is Italian through and through. Connie is a couple years older than I am, has more hair than I do, and a consistently better manicure. Her desk is strategically placed in front of Vinny's door, the better to slow down stiffed bookies, process servers, hookers with obviously active herpes, and a stream of perverted degenerates with get-rich-quick schemes hatched while under the influence of who knows what. I live 10 minutes from the office on a day without traffic. This wasn't one of those days, and it took Lula 20 minutes to get a red Firebird down Hamilton Avenue. Vinny's bail bonds business is located on Hamilton, just up from the hospital, and between a dry cleaner and a used bookstore. There's a front room with large plate glass windows, an inner office where Vinny hides, a row of file cabinets, and behind the file cabinets is storage for everything from guns and ammo to George Foreman grills held hostage until some poor burger-loving slob comes up to trial. Lula parked at the curb, and we pushed through the door into the front room. Lula plunked herself down on the brown fake leather couch that was positioned against the wall, and I settled into an orange plastic chair in front of Connie's desk. The door to Vinny's office was open, but there was no Vinny.
"What's up?" I asked Connie. "Mickey Gritch snatched Vinny. Last night he caught Vinny in a compromising position, pants down on Stark Street on the corner of Stark and 13th. And from what I've pieced together, Gritch and two of his boys dragged Vinny at gunpoint into the back of a Cadillac Escalade and took off."
"I know that corner," Lula said. "That's Maureen Brown's corner. Maureen and me used to hang out back when I was a hoe. She wasn't as good a hoe as me, but she wasn't no skank hoe either."
Lula worked Stark Street prior to her job as file clerk. She had a rocky beginning, but she's getting herself together, and I suspect someday she'll be the governor of New Jersey. Anyway, I guess Vinny had a run of bad luck at the track, and now he owes Mickey $786,000, Connie said.
Whoa, Lula said. That's a lot of money.
Some of it's interest, Connie told her. The interest might be negotiable. Mickey Gritch has been Vinny's bookie for as long as I can remember. And this isn't the first time Vinny's owed money, but I can't ever remember him owing this much money.
Mickey Gritch works for Bobby Sunflower now, Lula said. You don't want to mess with Bobby.
Is this serious? I asked Connie.
Times are tough and Mickey wants his money, Connie said. Too many people stiffen him, so they're going to make an example of Vinny. If Vinny doesn't come up with the money by the end of the week, they're going to kill him. Bobby Sunflower would do it, Lula said. He made Jimmy Sanchez disappear, permanently. Lots of other people do, from what I hear.
Have you gone to the police? I asked Connie.
The police aren't my first choice. Vinny owes this guy for illegal gambling. Knowing Vinny, it's possible some of the money came out of the business. We used to be owned by Vinny's father-in-law, you know, but last year we were sold to a venture capital company based in Trenton. The venture capitalists aren't going to tolerate Vinny's gambling with their money. If this gets out, we could all be out of a job.
What about the father-in-law? Lula asked. Everyone knows he got a lot of money. Plus, he could squeeze Bobby Sunflower.
Vinny's father-in-law is Harry the Hammer. As long as Vinny does right by Harry's daughter Lucille, it's all good. But I suspect Harry wouldn't be happy to hear Vinny got snatched while he was boffing a Stark Street hoe.
Gritch already went to Harry. Not only won't Harry fork up the money to spring Vinny, if Vinny gets out of this alive, Harry will bludgeon him to death, Connie said.
Well, that settles it then, Lula said. I guess it's adios, Vinny.
Personally, I could use one of them breakfast sandwiches from Cluck in a Bucket. Anyone interested in a Cluck in a Bucket run?
If there's no Vinny, there's no bail bonds office, Connie said. No bail bonds office means we don't get paid. We don't get paid, and there's no Cluck in a Bucket for anyone.
That's not good, Lula said. I'm used to a certain standard of living. Cluck in a Bucket is one of my first food choices. Not to mention I got bills. I charged a fabulous pair of Via Spiegas last week. I only wore them once, so I guess I could take them back. But then I don't have shoes to wear with my new red dress, and I got a date Friday worked around the dress.
We don't have a lot of options, Connie said. We're going to have to do this ourselves. Vinny was like a fungus on my family tree. He was a good bail bondsman, but a slime ball in every other aspect of his life. He had the slim, boneless body of a ferret. He wore his brown hair slicked back, his pants too tight, his shoes too pointy, and he left too many of his sleazy shirt buttons unbuttoned. He wore multiple rings, chains, bracelets, and, on occasion, an earring. He gambled on everything, fornicated with anything, and wasn't beyond an adventure into the kinky. But the truth is, in spite of all this, deep down inside, I was worried about Vinny. When times were tough and no one else would give me a job, Vinny came through for me. Okay, so I had to blackmail him, but the bottom line is, he gave me the job. I'd like to help, I said, but I don't have that kind of money. That was a gross understatement. I didn't have any kind of money. I was a month behind on my rent, my car was trash, and my boyfriend's dog ate my sneaker. Actually, I use the term boyfriend loosely. His name is Joe Morelli, and I'm not sure how I categorize our relationship. Sometimes we were pretty sure it was love, and other times we suspected it was insanity. He's a Trenton plainclothes cop with a house of his own, a grandmother from hell, a lean, muscled body, and brown eyes that can make my heart skip beats. We grew up together in lots of ways, and the truth is, he's probably more grown up than I am.
I wasn't thinking of money, Connie said. You're a bounty hunter. You find people. All you have to do is find Vinny and bring him in.
Oh, no. No, no, no. Not a good idea. This is Bobby Sunflower we're talking about. He's mean. He wouldn't like it if I stole his hostage.
Hey, girl, Lula said. They're going to ventilate Vinny if you don't do something. And you know what that would amount to?
No Via Spiegas?
You bet your ass.
I wouldn't know where to begin, I said.
You could begin with Ranger, Lula said. He knows everything, and he's got a thing for you.
Ranger is the other man in my life. And if I described my relationship with Morelli as confused, there would be no words for my relationship with Ranger. he's former Special Forces, currently runs and partially owns a security firm, is drop-dead handsome in a dark Latino kind of way, and is sex walking. He drives expensive black cars, wears only black clothes, and he sleeps naked. I know all this firsthand. I also know prolonged Ranger exposure is dangerous. Ranger can be addicting, and it's a bad addiction for a traditionally raised woman like me, since his life plan doesn't include marriage. For that matter, considering the number of enemies Ranger's made, his life plan might not even include living. Do you have any suggestions other than Ranger? I asked Lula.
Sure, I got lots of suggestions. Mickey Gritch is easy to find. Vinny got him in his Rolodex. Hell, Gritch probably has a website and a Facebook page.
Do you know where he lives, where he conducts business, where he might have Vinny stashed?
No, I don't know none of those things, Lula said. Hey, wait a minute. I know one of them. I know where he does business. He does it from his car. He drives a black Mercedes. It's got purple pimp lights running around the license plate. Sometimes I see him parking in the lot next to the 7-Eleven on Marble Street. It's a good spot since it's close to the government buildings. You work all day in government and you want to either blow your brains out or buy a lottery ticket.
What about Bobby Sunflower? I asked her.
Nobody knows where he hangs. He's like the Phantom. He comes and goes and disappears like he's smoke.
I guess we could sit at 7-Eleven and watch for Gritch, I said.
Hold on, Connie said. Let me run him through the system. If he owns a car, I can give you a home address.
People have a television idea about bounty hunters chasing felons down back alleys and kicking in doors in the middle of the night. I've chased a few guys down back alleys, but I've never mastered the art of door kicking. Mostly, real bounty hunters track people on the computer and make sneaky phone calls pretending to be conducting a survey or delivering a pizza. The age of electronic information is pretty amazing. Connie has computer programs that will help you access your next-door neighbor's third-grade report card.
I have a couple addresses for Gritch, Connie said. One is his home address, and the other is his sister's. Her name is Jean. Looks like she's a single mom. Works at the DMV. I have 6 business properties for Bobby Sunflower. A pawn shop, a garage, a car wash, a residential slum on Stark, a titty bar, and a mortuary.
The translation was that Sunflower was into fencing stolen goods, chopping up stolen cars, laundering money, pimping women, and probably the mortuary had a crematorium.
So I guess we gotta keep Vinny from visiting Bobby Sunflower's mortuary, Lula said.
What about all my open bonds cases, I asked Connie. Last week he gave me 6 guys who failed to appear for court, and that was on top of a stack of older files. I can't look for Vinny and find felons at the same time.
Sure we can, Lula said. Probably half of those idiots you're looking for will be at Sunflower's titty bar. I say we go do some surveillance, and first thing we stop at the bakery. I changed my mind on the breakfast sandwich. I'm in a donut mood now.
I followed Lula out of the office, and 3 minutes later, we were parked at the curb in front of Tasty Pastry.
I'm only getting 1 donut, Lula said, getting out of the Firebird. I'm on a new diet where I only have 1 of anything. Like, I can have 1 pea, and I can have 1 piece of asparagus, and I can have 1 loaf of bread.
We walked into the bakery, and conversation stopped while we sucked in the smell of sweet dough and powdered sugar, and we gaped at the cases of cakes and pies, cookies, cinnamon rolls, donuts, and cream-filled pastries.
I don't know what I want, Lula said. How can I choose? There's too much, and I only got 1 donut. I can't be making a mistake on this. This is critical. I could ruin the whole rest of the day if I picked the wrong donut.
I had my donuts bagged and paid for, and Lula was still undecided, so I went outside to wait in the morning sunshine. I was debating which of the 2 donuts I'd eat first, and before I reached a decision, Morelli's green SUV rolled to a stop in front of me. Morelli got out and walked over. His black hair was curling along his neck and over his ears, not by design, but by neglect. He was wearing jeans and running shoes and a blue button-down shirt with the sleeves rolled. At 6 foot, he was half a head taller than me, which meant if he stood close enough, he could look down my tank top. Are you working? I asked him.
Yeah, I'm riding up and down the street doing cop things.
He hooked his finger into my scoop neckline and looked in.
Geez, I said.
It's been a while. I wanted to make sure everything was still there.
You could ask.
If I guess what's in the bakery bag, do I get one of the donuts?
No,
You got a Boston cream and a jelly donut.
I narrowed my eyes at him. How do you know that?
It's what you always get.
The door to the bakery was shoved open, and Lula barreled out.
Okay, she said. I'm ready to go rescue Vinny.
She realized Morelli was standing next to me, and she did a fast stop.
Oops. Rescue Vinny?
Morelli asked. He's sort of missing, I told him. Morelli took the Boston cream out of the bag, ate half, and gave the rest to me.
Word on the street is that a bunch of people are very unhappy with Vinny. Word is, he owes a lot of money. Do you need help?
Would I have to file a police report?
No, but you'd have to give me the rest of the donut.
Thanks for the offer, but I have some leads. I'll stumble along on my own this morning and see what turns up. Morelli gave me a quick kiss and jogged back to his car. I looked at the two bags Lula was holding. I thought you were getting just one donut.
And that's exactly what I did. I got one of everything. I'm telling you, this is a beauty of a diet.
We sat at the small table in front of the bakery and ate our donuts while I read through the files on Mickey Gritch and Bobby Sunflower. We have home addresses for Gritch and his sister, but I can't see Gritch stashing Vinny in either of those places, I said to Lula. That leaves Bobby Sunflower's businesses. The pawn shop is on Market Street, the car wash is in Hamilton Township, and the restaurant Stark Street. Let's do drive-bys and see if anything jumps out at us.
Might as well do the car wash first, Lula said. If I like the looks of it, I might let them wash my Firebird.
Chapter 2 Bobby Sunflower's car wash was next to Figueroa Diner. It didn't look like it had a lot of room for holding a bail bondsman hostage, but it advertised brushless washing and personal attention, so Lula got into line. I don't know about this car wash, I said to Lula. I don't like the looks of the attendants.
You mean on account of their wagging their tongues at us and making kissy sounds?
Yeah. Plus the multiple piercings, tattoos, ridiculous homie pants, and I was pretty sure one of them had a boner.
They're just being boys, Lula said.
I looked in my bag to see if I had pepper spray or a stun gun. The pack of idiots swaggered over to us, and one leaned in the window at Lula.
Hey, Mama, he said. We gonna wash your car like it never been washed before.
This ain't no ordinary car, Lula said. This is my baby. I don't want to see no scratches on it when you're done.
You be nice to me and my boys, and we'll wash your baby by hand.
How nice do I gotta be? Lula asked.
Real nice, he said, smiling wide so we could see he had industrial-grade diamonds embedded in his decayed teeth.
That's disgusting, Lula said. You need to show some respect and act like professional car washers, and get your head out of my window.
I think me and my boys need to show you what we got, and maybe we teach you some respect.
Lula pulled her Glock out of her purse and stuck it in his face.
You got 10 seconds before I blow your nose off, Lula said.
Yeah, Mama, the guy said.
They all turned and ran, and Lula squeezed off 6 rounds, managing to miss all of the car washers at pretty much point-blank range.
Huh,
Lula said, rolling her window up and driving out of the lot.
They don't make these guns like they used to. I can't believe I didn't hit a single one of those fools.
Next stop was a pawn shop. Lula parked on the street, and we got out and looked around. There was an apartment above the shop, but so far as we knew, it wasn't owned by Sunflower. A consignment store was to one side of the pawn shop, and a pizza place was to the other side. This doesn't look promising, I said to Lula, but I'm going to go in and scope it out.
Who am I? Lula wanted to know. Am I good cop or bad cop?
You're nothing. There's no cop. We're just browsing and leaving.
No problemo. I can do that. I'm an excellent browser.
We went inside the pawn shop. Lula walked up to the counter, looked in the display case, and called the pawn shop guy over.
It's not like I need the money or anything, but I was wondering how much I could get for this ring I got on, Lula said. As you could see, it's got a ruby in the middle with some diamond chips around the edge, and it's in a genuine gold setting.
Is that a real stone?
He asked her.
You bet your ass it's real. A gentleman gave me this ring for certain favors. He bought it for his wife, but decided I earned it.
I don't suppose you have any documentation, like an appraisal.
Say what?
I guess I could give you 45.
4,500?
Lula asked.
No, just 45. Cripes, lady, what do I look like, a sap?
No. You look kind of hot,
Lula said, leaning her boobs on the counter.
What do you got in that back room, sugar?
There's no back room, just a bathroom that even I won't use. Moving on,
Lula said, and she turned on her heel and sashayed out of the pawn shop. 10 minutes later, we were idling in front of Sunflower's garage on Lower Stark. It was a one-story cinder block structure with three bays, all doors open. I can't see them keeping Vinny here, I said to Lula. There are too many people around, and there's no space to hide someone. Next stop was the topless bar. The neon sign was flashing, and electronic dance music dribbled out the open door. A wasted guy in a baggy white t-shirt leaned against the graffiti-covered building, smoking. He looked at us through slitted eyes, and Lula drove on.
Nothing but trouble there, she said.
We parked in front of the mortuary and stared at the building. Brown brick, two stories, upper windows were blacked out. There was a magenta and black awning over the door, and Mellon Funeral Parlor was written on the awning.
I don't know what's more depressing, Lula said, this dreary-ass funeral home or a titty bar in the morning.
Maybe the bar was serving breakfast.
I didn't think of that, Lula said. I guess that would be okay.
This place has real hostage potential. I'd go in and pretend I'm a customer, but I don't look like I belong in this neighborhood.
You mean on account of you're the only white woman on this whole street, dead or alive?
Yeah.
I see your point, but I'm not going in there. I hate funeral parlors, and I hate dead people even more. I get the creepy crawlies just sitting here thinking about it.
Okay, we'll do this later. Let's take a look at the apartment building. The apartment building was half a block away and looked like the Tower of Terror. It was four stories tall, black with grime, and slightly lopsided.
Holy bejesus,
Lula said, eyes bugged out, looking at the building.
This is scaring the crap out of me. This is like where Dracula would live, if he didn't have any money and was a crackhead. I bet it's filled with rabid bats and killer snakes and hairy spiders as big as dinner plates.
I thought it looked like it would be filled with despair and craziness and broken plumbing. Either way, it wasn't anywhere I wanted to go. Unfortunately, it was also a good place to stash Vinny. How bad do we want to find Vinny? I asked Lula, unable to take my eyes off the hellish building.
The way I see it, either we find Vinny or I'm going to be working the fry basket at Cluckin' a Bucket. Not that there's anything wrong with the fry basket, but all that grease floating in the air isn't going to be good for my hairdo. And what if they already got someone working the fry basket? What if I can't get another job and they come repossess my Via Spigas?
And what if I don't come through and they kill Vinny? How could I live with that, I thought. I speed-dialed Ranger's cell phone. Ranger picked up, and there was a moment of silence as if he was sensing me at the other end, taking my body temperature and heart rate long distance.
Babe, he finally said.
Do you know the slum apartment building Bobby Sunflower owns on Stark?
Yes, it's on the same block as his funeral home.
That's the one. I'm going in to look for someone. If you don't hear from me in a half hour, maybe you could send someone to check.
Is this a smart thing to do?
Probably not.
As long as you know,
Ranger said, and he disconnected.
I got two donuts left, Lula said, and I'm eating them before I go in, just in case I don't come out.
I angled out of the Firebird. Take them with you. If I don't go in now, I'll chicken out. The front door was ajar, leading to a small dark foyer spray-painted with a bunch of gang symbols. Stairs going up to the left. A bank of mailboxes to the right. No names on the mailboxes. Most were open and empty. Some didn't have doors at all. The message was clear. If you lived here, you didn't get mail. Two doors led off the foyer. Lula and I listened at the doors. Nothing. I tried one of the doors. Locked. The second door opened to cellar stairs. Lula poked her head in the doorway.
There's stairs going down, but I can't see nothing. It's blacker at night down there. Don't smell too good either.
I hear scritching sounds, I said to Lula.
Yeah, I hear it too, kind of squeaky.
And then a tsunami of rats swept up the stairs and over our feet.
Rats! Lula yelled. Rats!
I was frozen to the spot, too horrified to move. Lula was dancing, arms in the air, shrieking. The rats were wall to wall, scrambling around in a pack, filling the foyer.
Kill him! Kick him! Lula said. Help! Police! Call 911!
I snatched the bakery bag out of her hand and pitched a donut out the front door. The rats ran after the donut, and I slammed the door shut behind them. Lula collapsed against the wall.
Do I look like I'm having a heart attack? Did I get bit? Do I have fleas?
She took the bag back from me and looked inside.
At least you didn't throw the jelly donut. I was saving that one for last.
I closed the cellar door and took to the stairs. There were three doors on the second floor. Two were nailed shut with crisscrossed boards. No sound from inside. The third was open, and the one-room apartment was empty of people and furniture, but filled with garbage.
I'm going home and taking a shower when we're done here, Lula said. I feel like I got cooties.
The third floor had three doors, and all were closed. We need a plan, I said to Lula.
You mean like I'd be the Girl Scout cookie girl?
Yeah.
What if Vinny's in there and he's with some of Sunflower's stooges? We shoot him, right?
Only if we have to. Lula took her Glock out of her bag and stuffed it into her pants, snug to her backbone. She looked at me.
Don't you want to get your gun ready to go?
I don't have a gun.
What have you got?
Hairspray.
Is it firm hold? I might need some when we're done here, depending on what we do for lunch.
I crept down a couple stairs and pressed myself against the wall, hairspray at the ready should Lula need backup. Lula knocked on the first door. The door opened, and a fat, sloppy, bleary-eyed guy answered. He was maybe 50 years old, needed a shave, needed a shower, needed less alcohol.
Yeah,
he said.
I'm selling Girl Scout cookies, Lula said, looking past the fat guy into his room.
Aren't you sort of old to be a Girl Scout?
Not that it's any of your business, but I'm doing this for my niece, Lula said. She has an intestinal disturbance and couldn't make her quota, so I'm helping out.
What's in a bakery bag?
That's none of your business either. Are you going to buy cookies or what?
The guy snatched Lula's donut bag, slammed the door closed, and locked it.
Hey, Lula said, you give me back my bag.
She put her ear to the door.
I hear the bag rustling. You better not be fingering my donut.
Lula pounded on the door.
Give me my donut back or else.
Too late, he said through the door. I ate it.
Oh, yeah? Well, eat this,
Lula said. And she hauled her Glock out and drilled a bunch of rounds into the door.
Holy crap, I yelled, rushing at Lula. Stop shooting. You can't just shoot up someone's door over a donut. You could kill the guy.
Damn, Lula said. I'm out of bullets. She scrounged around in her purse.
I know I got an extra clip in here somewhere.
The door banged open, the fat guy looked out at us, and ratcheted the slide back on a sawed-off shotgun. He took aim, and I blasted him with hairspray.
Yow!
He hollered, rubbing at his eyes.
Shit, that stings!
Lula and I flew down the stairs. We took one flight, rounded the corner for the second flight, and crashed into two of Ranger's men on their way up. We hit them with enough force to knock them off balance, and we all went ass over tea kettles, rolling in a pack to the foyer floor.
Jeez, I said, getting to my feet.
I'm sorry. I didn't expect anyone to be on the stairs. I knew one of the guys. His name was Hal. He was a real sweetie, and he was built like a stegosaurus.
Ranger sent us to check on you,
Hal said.
We just got here and we heard shots.
Some moron ate my jelly donut, Lula said. So I shot him.
Hal cut his eyes to the third floor.
How bad is he? Do you want us to, you know, get rid of anything?
Like a body? I asked.
Yeah,
Hal said. Thanks, but not necessary, I told him. Lula shot through the door, and the moron came after us with a sawed off.
Gotcha,
Hal said.
I'll pass it on to Ranger.
Hal and his partner got into their shiny black SUV, and Lula and I got into the Firebird, and we all drove off.
It's too bad we didn't get to check out all the apartments, Lula said, on account of I had a real feeling about that place. I could see Vinny getting hid there.
I thought the apartment building was too obvious. I didn't know Bobby Sunflower personally, but from everything I'd heard, he didn't sound like a dope. If Bobby Sunflower was behind this, probably Vinny wasn't on one of Sunflower's properties. People like Sunflower had their fingers in lots of pies, and that's where I thought Vinny was being kept. In one of Sunflower's pies.
Now what? Lula wanted to know.
Drop me at Range Man. Chapter 3. Range Man is housed in a discreet seven-story building on a quiet side street in Trenton proper. If you didn't look closely, you wouldn't notice the small brass plaque by the side of the door that simply states Range Man. No other sign identifies the business. Ranger's private lair occupies the top floor.
Two more floors are dedicated to employee apartments, and the remainder of the building runs a security operation. Rangeman services private residences and commercial properties for clients who need a high level of protection. Plus, Rangeman does the occasional odd job of guarding bodies, finding bodies, and possibly eliminating bodies. Ranger was my mentor when I first went to work for my cousin Vinny. I suppose he's still my mentor, but now he's also my friend, my protector. From time to time, he's been my employer. And on one spectacularly memorable occasion, he was my lover. I have an electronic key to the underground garage and to Ranger's private apartment. It also gives me access to the building, but today I let the guy at the first floor reception desk buzz me in. I took the elevator to the control room and walked past the cubbies and consoles, waving to men I knew. Ranger's office was a few steps down the hall. He was on the computer when I walked in, and he smiled when he saw me. A big thing for Ranger, since he doesn't do a lot of smiling. He was dressed in Rangeman black t-shirt, cargo pants, and running shoes. Everyone in the building was dressed exactly like this, but Ranger's clothes fit him better. Possibly because Ranger was clearly at the front of the line when God was handing out the good body parts. You could dress Ranger in a black plastic garbage bag and he'd still look hot. "I need a tracking lesson," I said to Ranger. "You know how you always know my location? I want to be able to do that. I want to put one of those gizmos on someone's car."
"I can give you the gizmo," Ranger said, "and I can show you how to install it. But it won't do you any good if you can't receive the signals. It would be easier and less expensive if you let me track this person for you."
"That would be great. I need to know where Mickey Gritch is going. He's kidnapped Vinny, and I have to get Vinny back."
"Why?"
I blew out a sigh. "It's the right thing to do." Ranger opened his desk drawer, took out a set of keys, and tossed them to me.
"You need a car."
"So you're giving me one?"
"It's the right thing to do," Ranger said.
Rangeman keeps a fleet of shiny new black cars for employee use. Most are SUVs. There are a couple F-150s and a couple vans, and Ranger's personal car is a Porsche Turbo. The car I drew in the Rangeman lottery was a black Jeep Wrangler. It was noon when I parked the car in front of the office, and Lula and Connie had two pizza boxes open on Connie's desk. "That's a lot of pizza for someone only eating one of everything," I said to Lula.
"I'm not eating from Connie's box," Lula said. "I got myself one pizza, and that's what I'm eating. But if you want a piece, you could help yourself."
Lula's pizza had the works, and Connie had a cheese and pepperoni pizza. Since I was in a cheese and pepperoni mood, I went with Connie's pizza.
"Let me guess where you got the shiny black car," Lula said. "I'm guessing Ranger."
"It's a loaner." Lula selected another piece.
"Do you know what I think? I think that man is all bad and scary, silent on the outside, and soft and mushy on the inside."
I knew Ranger pretty well, and I wasn't sure what was on the inside, but I knew it wasn't soft and mushy. "Have you heard any more from Mickey Gritch?" I asked Connie.
"No, I got a phone call first thing this morning and nothing since. I guess Mickey called Lucille last night. Lucille called Harry, and Harry made a few inquiries and found out about the hooker. And by the time I talked to Lucille, she was having the locks changed on the house, and Harry was on a rant. I got the clear impression no one on that side of the family cares if Mickey Gritch offs Vinny."
"That's a shame," I said. "I know Vinny brought all this on himself, but it's still sad." I ate two pieces of pizza, chugged a bottle of water, and hiked my bag onto my shoulder.
"Where are you going?" Lula wanted to know.
"I have Ranger tracking Mickey Gritch, so I thought I'd take the afternoon to try to find Dirk McCurdle. He's still in violation of his bond."
"I thought his name was McCuddle," Lula said.
"Nickname," I told her. The papers branded him McCuddle because he married four women before the state of New Jersey wised up and arrested him. Besides being tagged for bigamy, McCurdle got caught shoplifting some very expensive lingerie. He said Social Security didn't give him enough money for him to keep up with the anniversary presents.
"He looks like a nice little old man in his newspaper pictures," Lula said.
Dirk McCurdle was 72 years old, 5'9" tall, pleasantly plump and pink-cheeked, had wispy white hair and a face like a cherub. "I have a feeling McCurdle is with one of his wives," I said. "One is in the Berg, one's on Cherry Street, and two are in Hamilton Township."
Hold on, Lula said. I'll go with you in case one of those wives gets out of hand and you need backup.
I glanced at the file Connie had given me. McCurdle's first wife was his age. All the other wives were in their late 70s. Probably I could handle them.
Anyway, I never saw any bigamous wives, Lula said. I want to see what they look like.
I thought I'd start with the most recent wife and work my way back. Margaret McCurdle lived in a garden apartment in Hamilton Township. The buildings in the complex were two-story red brick with white doors and white shutters at the windows. There were 10 apartments in each building, 5 up and 5 down. Margaret lived in an end unit on the ground floor.
This looks real normal, Lula said, swinging out of my Jeep, taking in the faux colonial columns in the front of the building. This don't look like a bigamous hideout. I hope I'm not going to be disappointed. I hate when that happens.
We crossed the lot to the front door, and I rang the bell. The woman who answered the door was about 5 foot nothing. Her hair was pale blonde and cut short. Her makeup reminded me of pictures of Japanese geisha. Exaggerated bow mouth painted with glossy bright red lipstick, white pancake makeup, and pencil-thin black eyebrows. She was wearing a magenta velour warm-up suit and white tennis shoes. Are you Margaret McCurdle? I asked her.
Yes. You aren't more wives, are you?
No.
Thank goodness, she said. I can't keep track of them anymore. I don't know how Dirk does it. He has wives coming out of the woodwork.
I gave her my card. I'm a bond enforcement agent, I told her, and I'm looking for Dirk.
Good luck, Margaret said on a sigh. I've given up looking for him. He went out for ice cream 2 weeks ago and never came back. And now it turns out I'm wife number 4. I read about it in the paper. I suppose I should get a lawyer, but they're so expensive.
What's it like being married to a bigamist? Lula asked her.
It's perfect, she said. He told me he was still managing his company in Des Moines, so he would show up on Thursday night in time to set the garbage out for Friday pickup, and then he would leave early Sunday. He was very attentive, and he was always a gentleman, and he was excellent in bed.
No kidding, Lula said. You and McCurdle have a lot of sex?
No, but we talked about it.
Do you know where he is now? I asked her.
Jail?
Not yet, I said. Lula and I said goodbye to Margaret McCurdle, and I drove us a half mile to Ann McCurdle's house on Sycamore Street. Ann lived in a small ranch house in a neighborhood filled with small ranch houses. Her house was pale gray with blue shutters and a blue door. Her yard was tidy, and it looked like someone had just mulched around her azalea bushes.
This is fascinating to me, Lula said, because I'm a student of human nature. That's why I was such a good hoe. I took an interest in my clients. And now here I am seeing all these bigamous wives living in all these different kinds of houses. Don't you think it's fascinating?
Actually, it wasn't high on my list of things that fascinated me, but I thought it was nice that Lula was fascinated. I rang Ann's doorbell with Lula hovering behind me. I rang a second time, and the door was answered by a wiry old lady with a paintbrush in her hand. She had gray hair, the color and texture of steel wool. Her bifocals were crooked on her face, and she was dressed in white orthopedic shoes and a shapeless cotton creation that was somewhere between a dress and a bathrobe. Mrs. McCurdle? I asked her.
Yeah, she said. Me and everybody else.
She craned her neck to look past Lula.
This isn't another one of them television interviews, is it? I'm painting my kitchen and I don't have my hair fixed.
I introduced myself and gave her my card. I'm looking for your husband, I told her. Do you have any idea where he might be? She pushed a clump of hair back from her face and left a smudge of lemon yellow paint.
I don't know where he is, and if you find him, I want to know so I can hunt him down and wring his neck. He started painting my kitchen this stupid yellow color 3 weeks ago and never came back to finish.
It's going to be real cheery when you get done, Lula said.
Cheery my behind, Ann McCurdle said. Every time I look at it, my blood pressure goes up. I'm popping pills like they're M&Ms. So I guess marrying a bigamist didn't work out for you, Lula said. It could have been worse. Just when I was getting sick of him, he'd go off on a 2-week business trip. That's a secret to keeping the magic in a marriage, she said. You don't see too much of each other. Men are only interested in one thing anyway, sex. And then after they get it, they go to sleep and snore. I noticed that, Lula said.
I thanked Ann McCurdle for her help, and Lula and I went back to the Jeep.
Maybe bigamists aren't as fascinating as I thought, Lula said, cinching her seatbelt. According to the newspaper, none of these wives knew there were other wives. Now that I'm meeting them, I could see how that could happen.
I motored out of the lot and turned onto Klockner Boulevard. His first wife lives in the Berg. I thought we'd try her next since it's on our way back to the office. The Berg is an odd-shaped chunk of Trenton bordered by Hamilton Avenue, Liberty Street, Chambers Street, and Broad Street. I lived in the Berg for my entire childhood, and my parents still live there. Houses are small, yards are narrow, cars are large, windows are clean. This is a neighborhood of hard-working second-generation Americans. Families are extended and proudly dysfunctional, although dysfunction in Jersey might be hard to measure. Thomasina McCurdle lived one block in from Hamilton in a single-family house with brown clapboard siding and brown trim.
This house looks like a turd, Lula said. How could someone live in an all-brown house? You'd think you were going into a turd every day. It's just my opinion, but I find that depressing. When you had company over, what would you tell him? The directions would be to turn off Hamilton and park in front of the house looks like a turd.
I had to admit, it wasn't the most attractive house I'd ever seen, but turd seemed harsh. Truth is, the bottom half of my parents' house was brown. And okay, if I was being honest, it wasn't such a great-looking house either. I knocked at the door, and a sturdy woman answered. She was early 70s, short black hair shot with silver, wire-rimmed glasses, dressed in a green pantsuit, large pearl earrings, lots of perfume. Thomasina McCurdle? I asked.
That's me, she said. And I know who you are, too. You're Edna's granddaughter, the one who burnt down the funeral home.
It wasn't my fault, I told her. People were shooting at me.
I suppose you're looking for my foolish husband, the bigamist.
We sure are, Lula said. And if you don't mind me asking, what was it like being married to a bigamist?
It was like being married to anyone else.
That's disappointing, Lula said.
Thomasina pressed her lips together.
Tell me about it. I was married to that idiot for 51 years, and 10 years ago he decided to just up and marry someone else. And then he goes and marries every floozy that comes along. What the heck was he thinking?
Do you know where I might find him? I asked her.
I imagine he's with one of his home wreckers.
Other than home wreckers, is there any place else he might be staying? A relative's house? A close friend?
I can't see him with any relatives. His brother died last year. His parents are dead. Our son lives in Delaware, and he'd tell me if Dirk was with him. Ernie Wilkes is his best friend, but Ernie's wife wouldn't put up with having Dirk in the house.
You look all dressed up, Lula said. Are you going out someplace?
No, I just got home. I was at Karen Shishler's afternoon viewing at Steva's.
Thomasina turned to me.
Your grandmother is there causing a scene because there's a closed casket. The viewing was over and she refused to leave until they opened the casket.
Thanks, I said. If you see Dirk, please call me. Chapter 4 3 minutes later, we were in front of Steva's funeral home. It was on its third owner since Steva, but it was still called Steva's.
I guess you're gonna go get your granny, Lula said.
Yeah, I'll just check to see if she's still here.
I'm gonna wait in the car if it's okay with you, Lula said. Not that I'm afraid of dead people or anything, but it gives me the willies.
Steva's is housed in a big white colonial on Hamilton. The front steps are covered in green outdoor carpet, and they lead to a wide front porch that spans the width of the house. I walked into the large lobby and heard Grandma arguing with the funeral director in slumber room number 3.
How do I know she's in there if you won't open the lid? Grandma said.
You have my word of honor, he told her.
Mitchell Shepherd owns the funeral home. He bought it a year ago and probably regrets his decision. People in the Berg take their funeral home seriously. And since the Berg lacks a movie theater or mall, the funeral home is most often the entertainment of choice. Shepherd is a mostly bald man in his 50s. He has a round face, round body, and his funereal uniform is navy suit, white shirt, navy striped tie.
Just a peek, Grandma said. I won't tell no one.
Can't do it. The family wants the casket closed. Grandma Mazur came to live with my parents when Grandpa Mazur passed on to wherever it is bacon-eating, whiskey-drinking, gravy-loving people pass on to. She's 5'5" on a good day, has tightly permed gray hair, a body that's mostly slack skin on spindle bones, and an attitude only old ladies can pull off.
I made an effort to come here today, and what good is it if I can't even see the deceased, Grandma said. Next time I'm going to Morton's mortuary. They never have closed caskets.
Shepherd looked like he'd pay Grandma to go to Morton's. He glanced my way and almost collapsed with relief.
Stephanie, he said, how nice to see you.
Well, for goodness sakes, Grandma said. Look who's here. Did your mother send you after me?
No, I heard you were creating a disturbance and I came on my own.
Just in time to give me a ride home, Grandma said. No reason to stay here any longer since Mr. Party Pooper won't open the lid for me.
I escorted Grandma out of the funeral home, and she stopped short when she saw the Jeep.
Isn't this a cute little thing, she said. This is a pip of a car. I always wanted to ride in one of these. How the heck do I get into it?
Lula climbed into the back seat and reached a hand down to Grandma. I got my hand under Grandma's behind, and we alley-ooped her into the passenger seat.
Good thing you came when you did, Grandma said. By the time I walked home, I'd be late for dinner, and we're having pot roast tonight. It wouldn't be right to be late for pot roast.
I love pot roast, Lula said. I bet you're having mashed potatoes and gravy with it, too. I love mashed potatoes and pot roast gravy.
You should stay for dinner, Grandma said. We always got extra.
If you're sure it's no trouble, Lula said. I wouldn't want to impose, and I won't eat much on account of I'm on this new diet where I only eat one thing. Like, I only eat one piece of pot roast and one glob of mashed potatoes and one green bean.
Have you lost weight? Grandma asked.
Not yet, but I only just started. I'm still getting the hang of it.
Like, what happens when you eat salad?
Does it mean you eat one salad, or does it mean you eat one piece of lettuce and one piece of tomato? It don't matter a lot since I don't understand the whole salad obsession anyway. Lettuce don't look like a food to me. And if you're gonna eat a tomato, I say put it on a burger.
My parents live in a two-family house. They share a common wall with Mrs. Markowitz, and both halves of the house are identical in construction. Living room, dining room, kitchen downstairs, three small bedrooms upstairs, and one bath. Mrs. Markowitz has lived next door to my parents for as long as I can remember. Her husband died years ago, and she lives alone now, making coffee cake and watching television. She's painted her half of the house lime green. My parents have always had their house brown on the bottom half and mustard yellow on the top. I don't know why. I expect it's a Trenton thing. The house hasn't changed much over the years. A new appliance when needed, new curtains. Mostly it's overcrowded with comfortable, nondescript furniture, cooking smells, and good memories. My mom has always been a homemaker. She's a younger, more filled-out version of my Grandma Mazur, and I think I'm cut from some of the same cloth. I have their good metabolism, oval-shaped face, and blue eyes. My dad is retired from the post office, and now he drives a cab part-time. I get my unruly hair from his side of the family. And also my perverted cousin Vinny. The table was set for three when we walked in. My mom quickly added two more place settings, and in minutes, my father had his head bent over his plate, forking in meat and potatoes, and my mother was at the other end, trying not to stare at Lula's fire engine red hair and tiny leopard print top that showed about a quarter of a mile of cleavage.
Isn't this nice, Grandma said, looking around the table. I love when we have guests. It's like a party. What were you two doing in the neighborhood, she asked me. Were you looking for dangerous criminals?
We were looking for Dirk McCurdle, I told her.
Wasn't that a scandal? Grandma said. Imagine having four wives. No one even suspected. He was such a pleasant man. I would see him at the funeral parlor when the Knights of Columbus would have a ceremony.
Do you have any ideas where he might be hiding?
Did you try all his wives? Grandma asked. One of them might still have a soft spot for him.
I have one left.
If that don't work, you could try Pip's bottle, Grandma said.
My mother blew out a sigh, and my father murmured something that sounded like crazy old bat.
Is that the red bottle you're talking about? Lula said. The one looks like a beer bottle?
Grandma helped herself to the mashed potatoes.
Pip swore by that bottle. He said it brought him luck. How does it work? Lula wanted to know. Is it enough to own it? Do you gotta carry it around? Do you have to rub it like a genie bottle?
I don't know exactly, Grandma said. I never saw Pip use it.
She looked over at me.
Didn't it come with instructions?
No.
Bummer, Grandma said.
The bottle is a bunch of horse pucky,
my father said.
Pip was a nut. He didn't know enough to come in out of the rain.
What about when he won $10,000 in the lottery? Grandma asked. How do you explain that?
Dumb luck,
my father said.
Exactly, Grandma said. It was the lucky bottle.
What about taking a leak in a thunderstorm and electrocuting yourself?
My father said.
Was that lucky?
Probably he didn't have the bottle with him, Grandma said.
What happened to my pot roast? Lula asked.
You ate it, Grandma said.
Lula stared down at her plate. She looked in her lap and on the floor.
Are you sure I ate it? I don't remember.
I saw you, Grandma said. It was the first thing you ate.
Do you think eating something counts if you don't remember?
Lula asked. No one knew what to say, and my father wasn't going to touch it. Lula looked down at her plate. She had a spoonful of mashed potatoes and a pea.
What's for dessert? She asked.
It better not be grapes.
Lula and I were back in my Jeep heading for Stark Street to check out Sunflower's funeral home. It was almost 8 o'clock and the sun was low in the sky. I'd stopped at my apartment to get a sweatshirt, and Lula had insisted we bring the lucky bottle with us.
Uncle Pip would probably be alive today if he'd taken his bottle with him, Lula said. If nothing else, he could have pissed in it instead of on that wire.
Not likely, I said. I can't get the stopper out. I think it's glued in.
Let me take a look at that bottle. Maybe I can figure it out.
I stopped for a light and pulled the bottle out of my big leather purse. Lula worked at the stopper, but it wouldn't budge.
You're right, she said. This sucker's in for good.
She shook the bottle close to her ear.
Don't hear anything rattling around in it.
She held it up and looked at it in what little light was left.
Can't see anything in it. The glass is too thick.
I think luck is a weird thing. It's hard to tell if you make it or if it just follows you around. And it seems to me it could just as easily be bad luck as good luck. It's not like it's a constant ability, like playing the piano or being able to cook a perfect omelet. I cruised by the funeral home and we scoped it out. There were several cars parked at the curb, and a clump of older men dressed in suits and ties stood talking by the open front door. Lights were on inside. Mellons was having a viewing. I pulled over and parked half a block away. I'll wait here and you go look around, I said to Lula.
Why do you get to wait here? Lula wanted to know. I'm the one who hates dead people. I should be the one to wait here.
You can't wait here. You're the friend of the deceased.
Fine, but I'm not going in alone. You're going to have to make yourself blend in. Just tart yourself up some and everyone will think you're a hoe come to visit.
I ratted my hair, put on brighter lipstick, took my sweatshirt off, and rolled my t-shirt so I had some skin showing. This is the best I can do, I said.
You're not all that hot, Lula said. You're never going to make any money looking like that.
Sure I would. I'm the girl next door.
You don't know much, she said. You got to have a short skirt to be the girl next door, and you put your hair in two ponytails.
I thought that was the Catholic schoolgirl.
The Catholic schoolgirl's skirt is plaid and pleated.
I put Pip's bottle back in my bag, hiked my bag up on my shoulder, and swung myself down from the Jeep. We made our way through the clump of men, through the open door, and into the foyer. Several older women stood by a table with a coffee urn and cups. I could see more women and a couple men in an adjoining room. The casket was in that room. So far as I could tell, this was the extent of the public areas. Small funeral home, I said to Lula.
I guess the embalming goes on upstairs, being that the windows are blacked out, and we know Bobby Sunflower likes to keep rats in his cellars,
Lula said. I want to see what's down the hall to the left. Stand at the front of it so no one can see me snooping. The hall wasn't long. It led to a small kitchen, stairs going up, and two doors. I opened one door to stairs going down. I held my breath and listened for a moment. No squeaking. I flipped the light on and whispered, "Hello." No answer. I didn't want to rescue Vinny bad enough to creep down the stairs. I closed the cellar door and tried the second door. It opened directly onto an alley and a small paved parking lot. A hearse and a black stretch Lincoln were parked in the lot.
I stepped out onto the cement stoop to get a better look at the back of the building, and the door blew closed behind me. I tried the door. Locked. Crap. The funeral home was in the middle of the block with no breaks between buildings. I was going to have to walk down the alley and around the corner to get back to Stark. Ordinarily, no big deal, but this wasn't the sort of neighborhood a girl wanted to stroll around in after dark. I moved to the alley and looked back at the building. Four windows on the second floor, all blacked out and barred, just like the front windows. I called Lula on my cell phone.
"Where the heck are you?" Lula wanted to know.
"I accidentally got locked out. I'm in the alley. Can you let me back in?"
"Negative. Bobby Sunflower just came down the back stairs, and he's standing in the hall talking to some idiot that's got killer written all over him."
"Go ask them if they've got Vinny upstairs."
"Funny," Lula said. "Why don't you rub your bottle and ask for X-ray eyes?"
"Are you being sarcastic about my lucky bottle?"
"Yeah, and I regret it. It's not a good idea to disrespect a lucky bottle. I'll meet you at the Jeep. Good thing you at least got your hairspray case to meet up with some of the locals."
Chapter 5. I power walked down the alley, keeping to the shadows where I hoped I wouldn't be seen. I scurried around the corner, and by the time I reached Stark Street, my heart rate was at stroke level. I did some deep breathing and tried to calm myself before I got to the car, so I wouldn't have to listen to Lula go on about how I should carry a gun. Okay, probably she was right, but I really hated guns, and I could never remember where I hid the bullets. Ranger had a remote door entry on the Jeep, so I beeped us in, and Lula and I sat watching the funeral parlor.
"Do you know Bobby Sunflower?" Lula asked me.
"No."
"He's a tall dude just come out."
"Is Sunflower his real name?"
"So far as I know," Lula said.
Bobby Sunflower was a little over 6 foot tall. He was lean with a long face and long cornrows that came to his shoulders. He was dressed in a pinstriped suit and a white shirt that was unbuttoned to halfway down his chest. He had a lot of gold chains around his neck, and I could see his diamond ring from where I sat. He had two men with him who looked like dumb muscle. They stood two steps behind while Sunflower talked to a fireplug guy in a bad-fitting black suit.
"That's the funeral director, Mellon," Lula said. "I was watching him from inside."
A black Cadillac Escalade with tinted windows rolled to a stop in front of the funeral home. Sunflower turned from Mellon and got into the Escalade's back seat. One of the gunners got into the front passenger seat, the other got in next to Sunflower, and the car moved off down the street. I put the Jeep in gear and followed the Escalade. I kept my distance, staying about a half block behind. They went all the way down Stark, took State Street to Broad, and I lost them on Broad. Too much traffic on Broad. I lost them when I couldn't run a light.
"I got a bad feeling about Bobby Sunflower," Lula said. "Some people just make you scared inside, and he's one of those people."
I turned off Broad and made my way through the burg to Hamilton and the bonds office. I dropped Lula at her car and headed for home. I was a block from my apartment building when Mickey Gritch passed me going in the opposite direction. Black Mercedes with purple pimp lights flashing around his license plate. Hard to miss. I cut my lights and made a U-turn on Hamilton. I put a car between me and Gritch, and I put my lights back on. Gritch turned right on Olden, crossed the railroad tracks, and wound around, ending on Stark. He took the alley behind the funeral home, parked behind the limo, and got out. I was around the corner on the dark side street, watching with my lights off. Gritch got out of his car, walked to the back door, and knocked. The door opened, Gritch walked in, and the door closed. I checked my rearview mirror and saw that a car had pulled up behind me. My pulse quickened and I was about to step on the gas when Ranger angled out of the car and walked to the Jeep. I got out and stood next to him and my pulse didn't drop back. Ranger at close proximity on a dark and deserted street would make any woman's heart race. "You scared the bejesus out of me," I said to him. "I didn't know it was you at first."
"Chet was monitoring the fleet, and he saw you make a U-turn and start tailing Gritch."
"And you were in the neighborhood?"
"No. I grabbed my keys and came out to watch you in action."
He did a full body scan on me.
"Is this a new look?"